Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It's said that about a 1 in 3 native pollinators is experiencing great decline both here in Oklahoma and the country. And that has a great potential effect on our agriculture as well as our backyard vegetable and flower gardens. Today we get a preview of a day-long symposium presented by Okies for Monarchs next week. Rewilding Oklahoma will provide information to rebuild and restore native habitat and the variety of life that native plants support. This day-long event is scheduled for next Wednesday, August 28th, at the Oklahoma City Zoo, and will feature information on how to preserve plummeting monarch butterfly populations, a key focus of Okies for Monarchs, but also to help all pollinators, from moths and bees to hummingbirds and dragonflies. Presenters include representatives from the Nature Conservancy, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Tallgrass Prairie Preserve, the National Wildlife Federation, and Pheasant and Quail Forever, who will offer prescriptive information on habitat restoration. While my guest today and the keynote speaker of the event, Benjamin Vogt, will offer a philosophic perspective on the use of native plants in our yards and green space. Vogt is a writer and prairie garden designer in Lincoln, Nebraska. Native of Oklahoma, he's the author of A New Garden Ethic, Cultivating Defiant Compassion for an Uncertain Future. He advocates for sustainable landscape design that uses less natural resources, like water, for example, and provides urban and suburban habitat for a variety of wildlife, suffering from both a decline in habitat and from rising temperatures from climate change. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa to talk about his book and preview some of the things he'll be talking about next Wednesday at Rewilding Oklahoma. And you can find information about the event at Eventbrite. Benjamin Vogt, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
In your book, you describe two gardening ethics, one where man remakes nature to work for him, thinking of natural landscapes that are not at all natural, and then using nature in much the same way we consume, I think, in that ethos. The other is a deep ecology where we really look to ecology to shape what plants we use and where we plant them. Could you describe that ethic?
Yeah, basically my idea of this new garden ethic is that in a time of mass extinction and climate change, how and for whom we garden matters more than it ever has before. So basically that means in traditional gardening, we see plants and we say, well, what can that plant do for me? What can that flower do for me? How can it make me happy? How can it make me feel? But now we need to rethink things a little bit and say, well, what can this plant do for other species? What can it do for native bees? What can it do for butterfly and moth caterpillars? Because we need to start thinking of our gardens as sort of the last refuge for a lot of the wildlife we've pushed out of both urban and rural agricultural areas.
You know, when it comes to insects, I think a lot of people still think of them as absolute pests. And certainly there are some insects that can do major damage to garden and vegetables species. But do we need to have a new ethic as far as how we consider insects? Because I think we've come a long way in thinking of caterpillars as being beneficial to a garden as opposed to something that can devastate a plant. But other species, we probably haven't evolved that much.
You know, insects, and this includes bugs as well. I'm going to lump them all together when I say insects. They are the base of the food chain. They're the base of life on this planet. Without them, we have practically nothing. We certainly have far less food, and we certainly don't have resilient biodiversity and ecological systems on the planet. So what I like to tell people is we want to see damage on our plants. I know that's, and I'm talking about ornamental gardens. A vegetable garden is a different breed, but if we have healthy, thriving ornamental gardens full of native plants around vegetable gardens, we're actually going to be attracting beneficial predator bugs like hoverflies and lacewings and lady beetles and spiders to come in and help us get rid of the pests we do not want eating our vegetable crops. I mean, that same philosophy applies to agriculture, where if we had strips of prairie going in the middle of fields and around field margins, and if we had hedgerows with diverse shrubs and trees, we would have more beneficial insects to help take care of the thugs that would be otherwise harming our crops.
The thugs, I like that word.
Yeah.
How difficult, you know, you're living in Nebraska, you grew up in Oklahoma, where you know that in many parts of the agricultural portions of the state, every square inch of land that can be used is cultivated. How difficult a discussion is that with farmers to say, look, I can save you money on pesticides and maybe some of the pests that affect your crop if you'll just turn some land aside?
That's a conversation I am fortunate that I don't have to have, but I have friends who do have them. You know, there's this wonderful program out of Iowa State University called Prairie Strips. That's capital STRIPS. And they've been working with farmers in Iowa, and this program is growing across the Midwest to have those strips of prairie. And they're placed strategically in fields, areas where there's a significant erosion and runoff, and they can mitigate those things by 90% and increase crop yield. So if you take out a couple of acres and convert it to prairie or hedgerows or something, you're actually going to increase your crop yield and reduce your chemical use on your farm field. So it's amazing stuff.
Tell us a little bit about your own evolution. You write about it in the book, A New Garden Ethic. It sounds like you grew up in central to western Oklahoma, someplace west of I-35. And it was a place that you described as, quote, devoid of nature, or so you thought in your youth. I like that.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of Oklahomans that still think that way, unfortunately. How did you come to see the beauty of prairie land for its own benefit?
It took a long time. I lived in Weatherford, Oklahoma for 10 years, and then we moved to Minnesota. And in Minnesota is certainly where I really woke up to nature, and it was the forests and the lakes and woodlands and all that good stuff.
It's an easy environment to wake up to nature, let's be honest.
yeah. But, you know, once I started working, after I finished my PhD, I wanted a new book project, and I wanted to explore my family settling western Oklahoma in the 1870s and 1890s. So I dragged my wife down to central western Oklahoma, and we sort of hit all the nature spots. my appreciation for the diversity that's in Oklahoma ecologically just skyrocketed. I was just, I haven't made it to the southeastern part of the state, but wow, it's just incredible down there. And I think maybe it's just like this for everybody. You got to get older before you appreciate these things.
Yeah. You write about Nebraska of having diverse ecosystems and eco areas. I think Oklahoma is just about as diverse, or maybe even more diverse, because we got swamps. I don't think Nebraska has swamps.
it feels swampy. The dew point was 80 yesterday. So.
But it is. It is. Both of these states that you grew up in and where you live now are tremendously diverse.
Yeah, and our culture is certainly still very European-based, where we're thinking trees. And we think that, too, in programs to help beautify cities. We think, oh, we need to plant a tree here and plant a tree there. And it is important. Trees cool urban areas, cool our homes, so we don't have to use air conditioning as often. But prairie plants are doing a lot of the same things, and they're as good at sequestering carbon as forests are. They're excellent at absorbing rainwater during heavy rainfalls. We're having more and more of those as climate change gets going, heavy downpours. So put these things together and we have incredible resilience and biodiversity and help for wildlife like pollinators.
I'm struck by something you said, so we're still very much attuned to this European version of trees, of created landscapes, using flower gardens that are not necessarily native to where we live. In Oklahoma, Nebraska, Pacific Northwest, we're still really much attuned in our gardening towards a lot of these European models. Why is that?
A lot of us are colonizers. We move into these places and we want to have this echo, this remembrance of where we were before. And I think now in the 21st century, it's sort of an echo and remembrance of what our parents had and what our grandparents had. And we want to touch that. But what they were remembering was, for all intents and purposes, the old country. So we come in and we reshape these environments, but we reshape them so radically. Just think about all the prairie we plowed up. We're just supercharging extinction and climate change just because, that's what we do. We have great machines to do it and all that good stuff.
Tell us about your evolution to discovering a beauty in the natural prairie, of the tall grass, of the short grass, in your area, you have the sand hills and these sorts of landscapes that take an eye to get used to seeing the beauty in them.
You really do. I mean, in a prayer, you have to stop and you have to sit down and you just have to be present in that place for, I think, a longer period of time. And I'm not saying that makes it more special or less special than other natural areas, but there's, you know, you have grasses that are 6 feet tall, 3 feet tall, 1 foot tall. There's so much life going on in there. There's so much minuscule life going on, and there's all these little cultures interacting that we would just so easily walk by and pass by. You know, my early days of gardening, I was getting ready to spray a milkweed caterpillar a monarch caterpillar that was on milkweed. I didn't know what it was. I just knew that this is what I had been taught growing up. You want to get rid of these pests. But I started to look closer. I started to research. And I started to look closer at all the plants in my garden and see, oh, that's a ladybug larva. Look at the benefit they have to eating oleander aphids on milkweed. And you just start to focus more. It's very zen-like.
Let me talk about your own, I guess about 5 or 6 years ago, I assume you live in a suburban location, and you basically took your nice lawn, got a sodding machine, pulled it all up, and planted a prairie garden in the front yard. Mm-hmm. What led to that decision?
One of my neighbors reported me to county weed control in May. I think that was May of 2014 or so. Yeah, so the whole summer I worked on my way. You know, it was just because there were some dandelions that had gone to seed. Maybe I had about a dozen or something. It wasn't like it was weedy or messy or crazy or lawn was too long. But I worked on my wife the whole summer, and by the end of the summer I finally got her to acquiesce. And so put in a couple hundred plants, and now the front yard's pretty much all designed prairie beds. It's not wild and crazy. Everything's in clumps and drifts, and I weed out there and I add new plants as I see fit. So no complaints back there, just complaints in the backyard where it is wilder.
Well, what about the neighbor's reaction to when you say, okay, I'm going to pull out this lawn altogether and put in prairie plants? I imagine you had to hear from him at some point.
I didn't hear from anybody,
okay,
and I
yeah.
never did get any more weed complaints from about the front yard. So, of course, you know, in my suburban development, nobody talks to each other, so...
Well, you write in the book about how a native landscape, can support like 8 times the numbers of insects, caterpillars, and bird species, and how changing climate zones are affecting natural landscapes. Can a prairie garden, the smallest size of a remnant of prairie, make a difference?
No.
Okay.
That's not the answer you wanted to hear, though. If we have hundreds and thousands of these, you know, to a degree, yes, they can. I think the benefit of these kind of gardens is more about in reconnecting us to other species, reconnecting us to wildness and the culture of wildness and the culture of other species, so that we sort of grow our empathy and our compassion and understand that we are part of this web of life and we're not at the top of a hierarchy. I think that's where the greatest power is. And when we can witness different insects using different plants, then our empathy and compassion just blossom.
So once you put in your prairie landscape in your front yard and pretty much wild in the backyard, how did that change how you viewed nature?
Well, I think my view of nature changed before that because, you know, once I scalp the backyard and kill my lawn and throw down a bunch of seed, you know, I'm in it. I'm deep. You know, I don't know. I think when I'm working with clients to change their landscapes, I think it's almost like they are reawakening within me the passion, my passions. I'm starting to see their passions grow, and that's what's really the most rewarding, not necessarily what I do in my landscape. So,
mm-hmm. Let me ask you about your clients. What are they drawn to the prairie landscape? What draws them to the prairie landscape for their yard, especially if it's in a suburban setting, where you're looking at manicured yards all around you, and all of a sudden you have this little bit of, and I don't want to say it's wildness because it's cultivated wildness, I'm sure, but it is wild compared to everything around them.
Yeah, it absolutely is wild, and you have to sort of use some old traditional tricks in garden design, like tiering plants, tall in the back and short in the front, and make sure you have paths, and maybe you have a bench and a sculpture. These sort of cues to care to let people know that this is a space that is accessible to humans as well, even though it looks a lot wilder than some boxwood and hosta and daylily surrounded by a bunch of wood mulch and lawn. But, you know, every single one of my clients who calls me, they're like, I want to do something. You know, there's a crisis here. I want to make a stand and I want to learn. And we need to help pollinators. I want less maintenance. Droughts are becoming more extreme. Let's do something.
My guest today is Benjamin Vogt. He's a writer and prairie garden designer in Lincoln, Nebraska. He'll be the keynote speaker for Rewilding Oklahoma. The symposium will take place next week in Oklahoma City. And he's the author of A New Garden Ethic, Cultivating Defiant Compassion for an Uncertain Future. Well, a big part of the book describes this changing system we have for our wildlife and wild plants in America. You know, you write that climate zones are moving, north and uphill every day. How's that affecting the natural landscape?
Well, if we just look at pollinators, a lot of pollinators are specialists, so they focus their life cycles around when specific plants are in flower, and that's certainly true for a good number of native bees. So they will just emerge, when a zizia, when a golden alexander is blooming, or when a goldenrod or an aster is blooming, and they'll use the pollen from that plant to cache their cells for the eggs and the larvae that will develop after that. So what happens with climate change is that flowers are blooming earlier now. So this sort of, we're getting out of sync a little bit with the flowers and the pollinators that use them. And that's one of the scary things that we can't really predict or fully understand yet.
I was struck by your discussion about the quote honeybee crisis. And you write, it says, well, yeah, we have a bee crisis, but it's the native bee crisis that we have. Honeybees are doing just fine, European honeybees. And the crisis there is of big ag who need that for pollination. But you said, actually, native bee species, if we took as much care with native bee species, we'd probably be better off because they do a better job of pollinating. And it seems like you write that the fruit come out a little bit better with native bee pollinators rather than honeybee pollinators.
Right. We have 4,000 native bee species in this country. Now, that doesn't mean you have 4,000 native bee species in Oklahoma or in Tulsa or in Oklahoma City or anything, but that's how many we have. And when you have dozens of different bee species coming to pollinate a tomato or a blueberry or orange or something or almonds or whatever, you're going to have far more effective pollination because you have more species doing different things. Bumblebees are probably one of our best species because they do buzz pollination. They have this they create this frequency where they buzz their bodies to shake pollen loose from hard to pollinate plants, especially thinking about blueberries. And then we have squash bees who do the same thing with squash like pumpkins. If we had more wild areas around our farm fields, we would not need to have honeybees. We would not need to stress them out. We would not have to worry about colony collapse disorder and all that stuff. But of course, the issues that affect honeybees also do affect the native bees, which is, you know, insecticide use, pesticide use, herbicides, and of course, habitat loss.
I also think there's also a difference in public opinion about a honeybee versus a bumblebee. I think there are still a lot of Americans that view bumblebees as pests.
Yeah, you know, we also have this idea that bees are aggressive, and that's because we know honeybees the best. Honeybees are aggressive because they're defending a hive. The vast majority of our native bees are solitary. They're nesting in the ground or they're nesting in cavities and wood or trees or whatnot, and they're not aggressive. They don't have a nest or a hive to defend. They're just doing their thing. They're just caching their egg cells 5, 10, 12 at a time or something like that. And they're not going to come after you. And a lot of them don't even have stingers. So there's really not that much to be afraid of.
Hmm. Well, I was sort of struck by something you wrote on your blog not too long ago. You were talking about tearing plants most recently and about deadheading plants. And you say that's really a bad idea.
I'm full of opposite advice, aren't I? Yeah. That stems from a conversation I was having with a client recently with some new plants we put in their garden, and they were asking if they should deadhead right now. We just put the plants in the spring, and I said, no, absolutely not. Please don't deadhead, because that's just going to encourage the plant to try and put up a new flower, and that's going to tax the root system and all the energy supplies down in the root system. because there's nothing more energy intensive for a plant than to produce a new flower. And of course, you want to leave those flowers up there so they have seeds so that birds can come by and eat. And then you also get more free plants, and then you have a thicker, more lush garden because you have those free plants. So those are just some of the reasons not to deadhead. Plus, my goodness, I know you guys get less snow down there than we do, but man, some of these plants just look outstanding in a snowfall. So,
well, and of course, deadheading is sort of the way to get more flowers off of a species. But when you think of it from this new ethic, you're really depriving the landscape of the seeds from whatever's going to feed on it. And they're never going to feed everything. They're going to spread as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. We have to think about not just what our plants can do for other wildlife, but what our garden and landscape practices can do for wildlife.
We were talking earlier about how climate change is affecting the climate zones. And I was really struck by something else you wrote, which was, you know, we all look at the hardiness index of, you know, and that hardiness index may be, say, a line may be in Nebraska and it may end up in Montana. He said, don't look at that. He says, you should look at the ecosystem. You know, the ecosystems, you know, the idea that something could grow as well in Oregon as South Carolina, I think was the example you used. It's just completely different ecosystems. And so often when we're planting gardens, we're looking solely to that hardiness index.
Right. Yeah. Ecoregion is the word. And let's stop paying, the USDA hardiness zones is just one way to look at what we should be planting. That's just looking at how cold it gets in an area. And obviously zone 5 on the East Coast compared to zone 5 on the West Coast, those are totally different plants. If we're using native species to help wildlife, you're not going to be using the same native plants at all. So we need to look at ecoregions, and the USDA also has ecoregion maps. And that way, you're actually thinking about what plant works in my specific ecoregion and ecosystem. How is it going to help biologic diversity, specifically wildlife and pollinator support? And so you can focus really in. They have ecoregion level 1, which are just huge sprawling expanses across the country, and then they go all the way down to level 4, and it gets really, really specific. In some places, it's just, you know, maybe 100 square miles or something. We have, I think, hundreds or so ecoregions, probably more, when you get really focused and narrow. So, yeah, ecoregion, not just USDA hardiness zone.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about, you know, there's a big difference between Lincoln, Nebraska and Tulsa, Oklahoma, certainly in both hardiness as well as the ecosystem might be surprisingly somewhat similar. I think we're perhaps a little more edge of the eastern woodlands as opposed to tall grass, which is probably where Lincoln is. But what are sort of some of the plants you think would stand out, even in a normal garden, that could add some biodiversity to add the idea of just that bit of natural landscape in a garden?
We have, I am sure, a lot of the same plants. I mean, eastern Nebraska shares an incredible amount of plants as, you know, New York State does. So let's think about low-maintenance, drought-tolerant plants, maybe something like Mexican hat, coneflower, or a rough blazing star. I'll try not to use the Latin. I know people sometimes go crazy over that. wild geranium in the spring, Baptisio, blue wild indigo, especially the dwarf variety. It's nice to have smaller species because people don't seem to like to have plants around them that are taller than them. I think it kind of scares them a little bit or something. and then fall, you can never go wrong with asters and goldenrods. We have so many insect species migrating and getting ready to overwinter, and they're just hungry for food, and goldenrods and asters are just absolutely some of the best plants we can have.
Yeah. Well, my guest today is Benjamin Vogt. He's a writer and prairie garden designer in Lincoln, Nebraska. He'll be the keynote speaker for Rewilding Oklahoma, the symposium to be held next week. And he's the author of New Garden Ethic, Cultivating Defiant Compassion for an Uncertain Future. Well, what are some of the things you're going to touch on next week in your keynote?
Oh, it's going to be a very deep cerebral talk with about 3 jokes. So I'm going to look at how, when we're gardening, we're actually working through environmental grief, working through the 5 stages of grief, and I'm going to explore a lot of philosophy and psychology about why we garden, why we do it, and how gardening really needs to change quickly if we're going to reconnect with nature, rewild our urban areas, and help species adapt to climate change.
You have to explain gardening grief.
Gardening grief. Well, it's so complex. You got to get the book, right? Now, if you were talking to a clinical psychologist or something, you're going through a period in life, maybe a loved one died or something. There are basically five stages to processing grief. There's anger, depression, denial.
Right.
I can't remember the other two.
Bargaining, yeah, and acceptance.
Bargaining. Yeah.
We're not in order, but that's the five. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it doesn't really necessarily matter what the order is either, but people go through it in different ways. But when I talk to people about native plants, sometimes they get really angry about the conversation when I say, well, we really need to be using more native plants, and they get really defensive. And I think sometimes it's because we're understanding that we are complicit in the extinction of a lot of species. And we understand that we are eradicating them and eroding the biodiversity and environments they depend upon. And it's a hard thing to think about that and process that. And then it's even harder to become empowered to make a difference and make a change, because there's just a lot of psychology on why humans are slow to change. And, I'll go through a little bit of that, along with probably 150 beautiful pictures.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I have to ask you is, you know, your clients come to you because they want a native environment, but do you still get a little bargaining?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'll talk about that in my presentation as well. Butterfly bush, especially, there's some bargaining. Or they might have an heirloom hosta or peony. They'll have their great-grandmother's peony from the farm or something. And I'm like, look, you know, I'm not standing here with a backhoe ripping out your plant. You know, keep what you want. Keep what's meaningful to you. We're doing a lot of good here. You called me. We're radically transforming your garden for a wonderful purpose. So keep that peony. Keep that hosta. I'll just come back at 3 a.m. and get rid of it when you're not watching.
Well, the name of the book is A New Garden Ethic, and he'll be discussing that at the Rewilding Oklahoma Symposium next week in Oklahoma City. Benjamin, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed our talk.
Benjamin Vogt is a writer and prairie garden designer in Lincoln, Nebraska, and the author of A New Garden Ethic, Cultivating Defiant Compassion for an Uncertain Future. It's published by New Society Publishers. He'll be the keynote speaker for Rewilding Oklahoma, a day-long symposium sponsored by Okies for Monarch, next Wednesday at the Oklahoma City Zoo. You can learn all about the event at okiesformonarchs.org, or you can look them up on Eventbrite for registration information. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed any of our recent programs, you can listen anytime, online, on demand, at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.